Hello and welcome to The Dip, and it is our question and answers edition where we will answer any question that you have about money.
That's right. And if you have a question, just drop it underneath any of our videos on YouTube and we'll answer it ourselves, or we're going to find the right person to get you the right answer.
That's right. And because it's our first episode, we trawled through different pieces of DW
News content. We were lurking. That's right.
And we found some interesting comments under these videos, and we thought we'd pick some of the best and put them to people that we know.
That's right. We do play favorites. And here we have one from Minu, who asks, if the tariffs are so bad, why did or do countries have them? And that was under one of our recent YouTube videos on Trump's tariff plans.
So we thought the best person to talk about this would be our DC correspondent, Janelle Dumoulin. And she's actually in New York at the moment because she was covering the United Nations General Assembly there. So let's take a listen to her answer.
I'm speaking to you now from the United Nations General Assembly in New York, where we have a lot of world leaders gathered. And I can tell you that a lot of these world leaders are really worried about US tariffs back home. However, it's not the main topic at the UNGA, but it is a topic. So thank you very much for your question. Now, tariffs are considered bad because they can raise prices for consumers, they can cause supply disruptions, and any kind of tariff, counter-tariff spiral can lead to a full-on trade war. However, they can be useful for governments in shielding domestic industry from cheaper imports. They can use them to say, look, we're standing up for the local worker in this time where we have a hyper-competitive global economy. But there are obviously downsides that you can't get away from. So, for example, I've spoken to a lot of auto suppliers on the US-Canada border. They now face soaring costs because a lot of the inputs that they make have to cross the US-Canada border several times back and forth. I've also spoken to American farmers who are worried that their biggest customer, China, is turning to Brazil instead for the things that they used to sell, like soybeans. So I guess the bottom line here is that tariffs could be useful political tools for governments, but on the ground, very often, they just mean higher prices, lost markets, and there's that word again, uncertainty.
Yeah, thanks very much for that, Janelle. So she did a fantastic interview with the United Nations General Assembly President Annalena Baerbock.
Newly elected.
Yeah, newly elected. And so you can check that out on YouTube, the full interview. It's on our DW News channel.
And last week we covered the U.S. government adding a fee of $100,000 for new H-1B visa applicants. And that's a visa that workers need. It's supposed to be for these highly technical, highly trained workers attracting the best talent to the United States, that kind of a thing. And DW's coverage on that did get a few questions, so we picked one out for you.
Yeah, so Shiny Things, great name, by the way, said, if they had just directed the Department of Labor to fix H-1B wages, that would have helped both the H-1B workers and domestic talents by putting all prospective hires on a level playing field. Adding the $100,000 fee reserves those workers for the companies with the deepest pockets. So I wonder if it has to do mostly with keeping the loyalty of Bezos, Zuckerberg, Musk et al.
I appreciated this kind of, now I don't want to say conspiratorial, I won't say that here on the internet, but this idea of maybe trying to connect the dots, especially because we saw that tech CEO dinner happen earlier this month, right? Though Musk wasn't there. But we asked a real professional, not just a professional speculator like me. We asked Ron Hira, a professor who focuses on labor policy at Howard University, and here's what he told us.
Yeah, so I don't know what the motivations are of the Trump administration in terms of thinking about the $100,000 fee, but what it really does is it addresses the profitability of those particular workers. So it's not really about the wages of the individual workers. It's not an approach that I've advocated, and I've been involved in talking about and analyzing the program for a couple of decades. How it plays out, we don't know. That doesn't necessarily skew to the highest wage workers. It'll be towards those firms that view, like with the other guests that we've talked to, view those workers as super valuable. And so in that sense, it'll help skew the allocation of those H-1B visas towards those most valuable workers, towards the employers. But again, there's going to be all kinds of exemptions, and we don't know how that plays out.
Yeah, so that was a great answer from Ronil Hira. And if you want a deeper dive on the H-1B visas, then check out our episode from last week.
And now we're going to turn the tables a little bit because NVIDIA is investing $100 billion in OpenAI. So we plucked an AI question out about this, hopefully not written by AI, but this question is from Square Peg Man, who suggests investment in AI should just be made in crypto. They said, why would all-encompassing AI really need real-world money? And I'm going to give that to you, Daniel.
So I think what they're saying is, if AI is so clever, why doesn't it just go and generate some Bitcoin and fund itself, basically?
Yeah.
I mean, the fact is that you need the hardware up front when you're going to be processing that amount of cryptocurrency, right? And so that's hardware that you're then dedicated to the crypto and not to the actual functions of being an AI. And there's a lot of high competition in crypto at the moment.
Right.
And I'm sure you can guess where all of these server farms are. They're in places where electricity is cheap, right? Whereas AI servers, they often need to be close to where the users are so that the latency is low. So when you send off a query, that you get an answer back fairly quickly. You don't want to be sending it necessarily halfway around the world in order to get to some place where the electricity is cheaper. So, you know, even if it managed to mine a little bit of crypto, the returns are tiny when compared to the billions in compute and energy needed for things like serious AI training.
Okay.
So I know what's on your mind right now. You want to ask me, why don't they just make their own cryptocurrency? Make up their own token, right? That would be a good idea.
A little crypto as a treat.
Yeah, I mean, because anyone could just generate their own cryptocurrency. By the way, if you have the right application for it, you could just generate a token. But I don't think anyone's buying Daniel Coin. I mean, I don't know about Cassandra Coin. At least it alliterates. But that's the problem, is that even if you make your own cryptocurrency, that doesn't make it necessarily any better because it doesn't have any intrinsic value. So even having control over the currency doesn't mean that you're going to convince humans to buy in on that.
To give it value, so to speak.
Yeah, so in the end, it's practical economics is the reason why you can't just get it to make its own cryptocurrency and fund itself that way.
So in reading about this story, though, about how NVIDIA is paying all this money to OpenAI, but those are for non-voting shares, but then that gives OpenAI a cash influx to buy NVIDIA chips, right? Yeah.
So it sounds almost like it's paying itself, doesn't
it? Yeah, I didn't want to say it.
No, but in the end, it looks like NVIDIA is securing a key customer, right? Because OpenAI has announced many times quite publicly, even with Trump, that they're going to spend massively on rolling out their infrastructure capacity.
Right.
And NVIDIA is just the best chip maker in the game when it comes to AI chips. So by securing them as a customer, they're basically making it harder for other customers to compete with NVIDIA and to undercut NVIDIA's prices potentially, because OpenAI would just choose the one that is cheaper if it's just as efficient as NVIDIA. So they're trying to square that circle before they come to it, if that makes sense. And OpenAI secures with this, what they get out of this is a secure source of compute. So they know, as we're expanding our operations, as we're making these plans for our company, we will be able to rely on this or this or this amount of infrastructure going forward, because they're tightly tied together with NVIDIA on this. So they know what is going to happen to the future in the future and what they can achieve and not achieve in terms of the hardware. And getting inside OpenAI's infrastructure planning gives NVIDIA influence over what features get prioritized, which helps its product roadmap in return. So, I mean, it's actually a tale as old as time, right?
Right.
It's just vertical integration. They're being another part of this product pipeline and controlling as much of that pipeline as possible. And seeing as these companies' fates are bound together anyway, that's how it kind of makes business sense for both of these sides to be playing together.
Thank you for clarifying that. I think that really makes a lot of sense. And I hope we answered that question as clearly as we could. And
I hope so as well.
Because we'd love answering your questions, honestly, and we're keen to answer more. So if you have any business-related news questions, please drop them in the comments. We're always there. We're always lurking. And we're going to pick out some really good ones for next time.
Of course, if you're watching on YouTube, if you're listening to us on any platform, remember to like us, subscribe to us, give us a 5-star rating, because that'll help us to reach even more people. And, you know, we'll see you back here, same time, same place. That's not how it works, is it? We'll see you on Friday. That's when our next episode is going to be out.
Keep it dippy.
Yeah, by the dip.